bloody two-week-long siege that took place in November 1979 at the Grand Mosque in Mecca, the holiest of all Islamic sites, has been expunged from history books in most of the Muslim world. Western countries, including the United States, have also paid scant attention to the violent confrontation that erupted in the mosque between a group of Islamic fundamentalists and the government of Saudi Arabia. But in his latest book, The Siege of Mecca, Yaroslav Trofimov argues that this would-be revolution in Mecca was a watershed event that marked the start of the international jihadi movement that later produced the 9/11 hijackers. His book is published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased that it brings Yaroslav Trofimov to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Great to be on the show.
Wasn't this violent confrontation a major news story at the time?
It would have been a major news story.
Well, I remember reading about it in the Times.
Well, very little was known at the time about what was actually going on. The Saudi government imposed a complete information blackout in the initial days of the siege, cutting off all phone line communications between Saudi Arabia and the rest of the world. And so this was really shrouded in secrecy. Western correspondents were not allowed into Saudi Arabia at the time, especially not into Mecca, which is off balance to infidels. And even reading CIA cables from the time, I was stunned to see that the world's foremost intelligence agency was complaining that we don't know what's going on because not Muslims, because only Muslims are allowed into that holy city of Mecca.
But there were many witnesses to it. There were people there. There were all the people who were on pilgrimages to Mecca. Why has this largely disappeared from history?
Well, this was really a tumultuous time in the history of the Muslim world. Just 2 weeks before the Grand Mosque in Mecca was invaded by the rebels, the American embassy in Tehran had been occupied by Islamic revolutionaries, the followers of Ayatollah Khomeini. And a couple of weeks after the siege of Mecca ended, the Soviet army invaded Afghanistan. So this was really a turning point in the history of the Muslim world, in the history of the Middle East. And this crucial event, the birth of the global Sunni jihadi movement, was really not noticed by the decision makers at the time. In a way, the West blinked and failed to see the importance of this event.
And the West didn't even understand very much about Islam. They weren't sure whether these people were Sunnis or Shiites, even though it was taking place in Saudi Arabia.
It was really sort of an almost tragical comedy of errors that happened at the time, because once the Carter administration realized that something is going on, they didn't know what exactly was going on. So the inclination was to blame the Iranians because so much of the attention was focused on Tehran at the time. And in fact, State Department officials, breaking the news of the siege in Mecca for the first time to the outside world, said the Iranians might be involved, should be involved. And Ayatollah Khomeini didn't take this very kindly. Within hours, Ayatollah Khomeini's office put out a radio broadcast saying, no, it's an American Zionist conspiracy to defile the sacred of the shrines of Islam. And amazingly, it was believed throughout the Muslim world. Raging mobs invaded the American embassy in Pakistan, burning it and killing Americans who were inside.
Well, this was really just an internal Sunni fight, in effect.
Well, the rebels who were in the Grand Mosque had very little respect for Iran or for Ayatollah Khomeini. They were Sunnis. In fact, one of the leading grievances against the royal family in Saudi Arabia was that it was, in their eyes, too tolerant towards the Shiites, who the rebels believed should have been killed or converted. So really, there was very little linkage. But what is interesting is just how much of a ripple effect this occupation created across the Muslim world, really inflaming that Americanism, prompting the American government to respond by withdrawing large parts of its diplomatic presence in the Muslim world, and even prompting a young Turkish man by the name of Mehmet Ali Agca to escape from jail in these days and to write a letter to a Turkish newspaper saying, I will avenge this American Zionist conspiracy by killing the Pope, which he proceeded to try to do the following year.
Did the Saudi kingdom consider the incident a major embarrassment? Is that why they kept it under wraps?
Absolutely. The very importance of the Saudi kingdom, its central role in the Muslim world, is caused by the fact that the royal family is the custodian of the two holy shrines. The holiest of these two shrines is the Grand Mosque in Mecca, which is really, in Islamic tradition, is the center of the universe. It's a place towards all Muslims must turn in prayer five times a day. So there, they lost the custody of the shrine for 2 long weeks to a group of rebels. And this prompted, at the time, calls to transfer the ownership of the site to an international community. And really, sort of the criticism started to mount in the Muslim world because of the Saudi Arabian government's inability to keep custody of the shrine.
Is this something that people ever mention in the Saudi kingdom today?
A lot of people know that something happened. A lot of people in the Islamic movement mentioned to me that this was really the turning point, the beginning of the modern jihadi movement, if only because this is the first time that the Saudi militants came together with Egyptian, Sudanese, Iraqi, and even a few African-American converts to Islam to launch the first operation of global jihad in modern times.
Although they were all led by a Saudi, a Bedouin.
Yeah, they were led by a Saudi Bedouin, by a former corporal in the Saudi National Guard, who was very active in the officially sponsored missionary outreach movement, and was really a protege of the man who would become the chief religious authority in Saudi Arabia in the following years, Sheikh Abdelaziz bin Baz.
This is these are Wahhabis.
Yeah, the official Wahhabi establishment, and really one of the turning points in the history of this, and with very long lasting consequences, was the fact that the Saudi government, in order to recapture the mosque, needed the support of the religious establishment. It's forbidden to fight in that shrine, so many soldiers refused to do so without a fatwa, a decree from the clerics. And these clerics extracted a very heavy price. They demanded that modernization that has been happening in Saudi Arabia up until then would be reversed, which the government had to comply. And also, the government had to start plowing millions and millions of dollars in its oil revenues to this Wahhabi missionary outreach effort that really bred this new generation of Al-Qaeda recruits.
Because the Wahhabis have gone throughout the Islamic world and preach their version of Islam, which is not the same as any number of others, and perhaps the most fundamentalist, but also the one that has jihad as a central part of it. It wasn't Wahhabism created by a group that that promoted jihad, holy war, as the only option for dealing with Christians?
Well, that was one of the tenets, but also the Wahhabi Islam is very conservative, so it really posits the us versus them mentality, and it shuns any interaction with the infidels. And so this network, this missionary effort that really started after 1979, transformed the way Islam is practiced throughout the world in places where a much more tolerant tradition had been implanted before, in places like Indonesia or West Africa or even Pakistan itself.
My guest is Yaroslav Trofimov, who's been a staff foreign correspondent at the Wall Street Journal since 1999, reporting extensively from Saudi Arabia and other Muslim countries. His latest book, The Siege of Mecca, The Forgotten Uprising in Islam's Holiest Shrine and the Birth of Al-Qaeda, is published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do we have any idea of how many people were killed during that confrontation in the mosque?
The official Saudi numbers, the official Saudi statistics, speak about hundreds of fatalities. However,
some Saudi police and then some of the rebels and then some innocent bystanders?
And innocent bystanders. However, when the Saudi Interior Minister, Prince Nayef, came up with his number for civilian and military casualties, he revised the number of military casualties shortly thereafter, and the new number was twice as large as the original one. He never came up with a new number for the civilians. And many of the civilians were pilgrims from India, from Africa, who were really hard to be, you know, nobody was looking for them. It was hard to account for them. And so diplomats that I've spoken with and eyewitnesses estimate that the true number of casualties was well in excess of 1,000 people.
Wow. Was there any significance in beginning the siege on November 20th, 1979?
This was a very special day. This was, in the calendar of Islam, the first day of the year 1400, the beginning of a new century. And the rebels believed that one of them, the brother-in-law of Juhayman al-Rutaybi, the leader of the rebels, was the Mahdi, the Muslim Messiah, who would really start this apocalyptic clash with the West and lead to a total victory of Islam.
they believed that this young man, Muhammad Abdullah, was the long-awaited Messiah?
They did. And
Have there been other messiahs over the years? I know in the history of Judaism, there have been any number of people who were proclaimed the Messiah, who of course turned out not to be.
Well, there is a tradition of a Messiah, of a Mahdi in the Sunni Islam, as is in the Shia Islam. And the so-called hadith, which are the narrations of what Prophet Muhammad had said or had done, speak and very clearly define. They say that the man should be called Muhammad Abdullah and should have a birthmark on his cheek. And they're very clear, specific characteristics. In the past, a number of such claimed Mahdis have arisen. The most famous of them, the Mahdi in Sudan, who had managed to rally the Muslim population of that country and to take over Khartoum and kill the British general who was holding it in the 19th century. So that the use of the Mahdi imagery has been widespread in the Muslim history.
And here, in this case, they believe that Muhammad Abdullah was the Messiah. Now they enter the mosque on the start of the Muslim holy year 1400 at dawn. But weren't there an awful lot of people in the mosque even then?
Well, the mosque was packed precisely because this was the dawn prayer, the first prayer of a new century. There were about 100,000 worshippers from all over the world in the mosque. So once the rebels took over this enormous stadium-sized enclosure, they bolted shut the gates, they dispatched their snipers to the tops of the minarets, and they forced everybody inside the mosque to pledge allegiance to them, to renounce their loyalties to the existing Muslim leaders. And they handed out the manifesto, which was then taken all over the Muslim world. And the speech of the leader of the rebels was broadcast throughout central Mecca by the very powerful loudspeakers that were installed inside the mosque that usually relay the prayers.
How many people in his rebel group?
The numbers that I've seen suggested was about 500 to 700. However, many of the worshippers who were inside the mosque were convinced by this sermon. They believed that the Messiah had come, and they joined the rebels.
It's interesting that you said that most of them were Saudis, any number of them also Bedouins, like Juhavin, but they were also people from Egypt, African-American converts to Islam. How did he attract these followers? Is he a charismatic guy?
He was a very charismatic guy, but also he had written a book of epistles, his messages, expounding his ideology that was printed in Kuwait and was distributed all over the Muslim world, especially in Egypt, where it was very popular in the circles of the Gamaat Islamiyah on Cairo University, where this generation of jihadists such as Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two of Al-Qaeda today, were really sort of entering the radical movement. And many of the clerics from Egypt traveled to Mecca, especially to take part in the uprising. Also, Juhayman was very popular among the students in the new Islamic universities in Medina and in Riyadh. And these students had a very large foreign student body, including Americans who were learning about Islam on scholarships funded by the Saudi state.
But Juhayman wasn't a unique character. He's actually doing this at a time when a lot of other people are thinking along similar lines.
Yes, but he was very important in the movement, this missionary movement within Saudi Arabia, because a few years before the uprising, Sheikh bin Baz, who would later become the Grand Mufti and then was the director of the Islamic University, launched this outreach program and trying to really bring back the youth to the strictest form of Islam. And Juhayman was very prominent in that movement. He was going all over the country preaching and traveling and recruiting the younger generation to the movement. And it's this initial support from the official establishment that really gave him legitimacy.
Juhayman had smuggled guns into the mosque in coffins. Did pilgrims often bring coffins into the mosque?
At the time, it was a very widespread practice because, according to the Muslim tradition, a prayer in the Grand Mosque is worth 10,000 prayers elsewhere. And so people who try to ensure that the deceased relatives would receive the necessary blessings and end up in paradise, and they would breathe the decomposing bodies into the Grand Mosque. The rebels have hidden many of their guns and ammunition inside these coffins, but they also used a more traditional entry point. At the time, the Bin Laden Company, the company established by Osama Bin Laden's father, had been carrying out maintenance work in the mosque. Much of the structure has been built in the 1950s by the Bin Laden Company. And so the rebels used an opening maintained by the company and drove 3 truckloads of weapons and ammunition with help and at least connivance of some of the personnel of the Bin Laden company.
And I'm assuming Osama bin Laden was aware of this. How old was he at the time?
Osama bin Laden was in his late 20s at the time. And he was not personally involved in the siege of the Grand Mosque. But he was living in Jeddah, about an hour's driving away. His older brother, who was at the time the head of the bin Laden company, was helping the Saudi forces to take over the mosque. But Osama himself was really shocked by what had happened. And for him, it was a turning point. He later said that his loyalty to the House of Saud began to fracture, and because of what he saw as the defilement of the shrine by the Saudi military.
But what about the defilement of the shrine by the rebels? Doesn't Islamic law strictly forbid bringing weapons into the Grand Mosque? How did Juhayman justify bringing those guns into a sacred place?
Well, in Juhayman's explanations to his followers, he said that we're only coming there to defend the Mahdi in case we're attacked. We will not be the first ones to shoot. And he convinced many of the members of the group to do so. Also, it's interesting that many of them had very vivid dreams about this young man, Muhammad Abdul, being the Mahdi in in the days before the attack. There was sort of a case of almost mass hysteria in that movement. Several hundred people had the very same dream. This was a very special time. And
they had the Messiah.
And they had the Messiah coming, and it was a new century.
Yaroslav Trofimov's book, The Siege of Mecca, The Forgotten Uprising in Islam's Holiest Shrine and the Birth of Al-Qaeda, is published by Doubleday. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Yaroslav Trofimov, who has been a staff foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal since 1999, and he has reported extensively from Saudi Arabia and other Muslim countries. His latest book is The Siege of Mecca, The Forgotten Uprising in Islam's Holiest Shrine and the Birth of Al-Qaeda, published by Doubleday. So when you were living in Saudi Arabia, did you bring this up with people? Did you ask them about it?
Well, yes. I asked people about this, and it's amazing how little the young generation knows about the fact that the shrine had been lost to rebels for 2 weeks. The Saudi government has done a very good job in suppressing all information about it. So as I started researching for the book, it was really a very tough effort. I had to go to all the Islamic activists I had met in previous years while reporting for the Wall Street Journal, really asking one by one, do you know anyone who's been in the mosque, who took part in this? And it took weeks and weeks and weeks of tracing the few survivors, because most of the rebels who were captured in the mosque and who were adults at the time were killed. They were either beheaded in public or executed in secret in the following month. So the only survivors from among the rebels are the men who at the time were 16, 14, 15 years of age at the time. And I managed to track down a few of them, and a few of them actually did agree to speak with me despite the obvious risks they were running.
Juhayman and his followers held discussions with Saudi religious leaders, including Sheikh bin Baz, who, as you say, later became the supreme religious authority in Saudi Arabia before they attempted the takeover. How come the Saudi government didn't hear of it? After all, the secret police in Saudi Arabia are everywhere, aren't they?
Well, they are everywhere, but I have spoken to quite a few members of the Interior Ministry and the police, retired now, but who were in service at the time, and they said that Juhayman's supporters were very numerous, and many of them were within the secret police and within the intelligence agencies. And others would just come to the homes of the officers and threaten them, saying, don't you dare do anything to stop this, because we will come and kill you. You know, there was the belief in the coming of the Messiah was quite widespread at the time.
Now, has Osama bin Laden talked about this incident? I mean, you said that it was a watershed moment for him, and you say for many other people, jihadists. But is this something that he would refer back to if he were talking about how his mind had been changed over the years?
He spoke about it at length in public for the first time a few years ago in this message to the Muslim nation that he recorded and that was posted on jihadi websites all over the world. And there he speaks about the anguish he felt as, you know, tanks and armored personnel carriers defiled the shrine, and how Crown Prince Fahd, in the words of bin Laden, didn't listen to any advice and stormed the mosque. And in more private conversations that had been relayed by his supporters, he had said that, well, the Juhayman and his supporters may have made a mistake in occupying the shrine, but the royal family committed a crime by using force and killing so many people in recapturing it.
But actually, the royal family waited a long time before it stormed the mosque. It waited 2 weeks, and it had meetings with senior clergy to work out a fatwa that would allow them to go into the mosque, because many Saudi soldiers refused to carry guns into the mosque.
Well, the Saudi government really had no choice. It had to go into the mosque because the pressure building up on the government was increasing with every day as long as the shrine was outside control.
Well, what was happening there? They hadn't killed anybody yet, had they? Juhayman, he had just seized control of it and not allowing anyone out?
Well, they killed a couple of people during the takeover itself. And then one of the rebels killed himself because a bullet ricocheted off a column. So there were casualties from the first day. And then, as the first police unit, not realizing the gravity of the crisis, moved towards the mosque, the snipers opened up from the minaret tops and decimated that unit. So the casualties and the body counts started to climb from the very first day. And the Saudi princes who were in charge of the operation, Prince Nayef and Prince Sultan, who then and now hold the jobs of the Minister of Interior and the Minister of Defense, were quite reckless. Prince Nayef famously said that, "I don't care how many are killed, because every soldier fighting and dying by the mosque will go to paradise and will be an envied martyr."
Well, we have this odd situation where the Saudi royalty tend to live rather, forgive me for saying this, maybe it's not all true, but rather profligate lives, whereas the religion of Saudi Arabia is strict Wahhabism. It became stricter as part of this deal?
It became much stricter. Until 1979, there were women newscasters on Saudi television.
Were they allowed to drive in those days?
There was some tolerance of driving. It wasn't official, but things were happening. The country every year was getting more and more liberal, more and more open. The enforcement of laws against alcohol was pretty lax. Suddenly, after 1979, all of this was reversed almost overnight. The police started raiding companies that employed women, and even Western companies. Women were taken off television. But most importantly, this is this beginning of the massive financial effort to spread the Wahhabist version of Islam around the Muslim world.
Now, there was an article in the Times recently about the possibility that women will be driving cars again. There's a television show in which a woman puts on a false mustache and drives a taxi cab. Women are starting to own their own businesses again and gain more economic power. So does that mean that we're starting to see the end of this cycle?
Well, we're starting to see the first signs of the royal family realizing that this bargain with the devil that they've struck is really backfiring. And a few years ago, one of the leading Saudi princes, the governor of the Asir province, which is the home of the mosque of the 9/11 hijackers, said that we've killed Juhayman, but we really made the mistake of adopting his ideology and allowing it to spread as if it didn't exist. So now some elements of the royal family realize what they have done and realize that a mistake has been made.
When the siege was taking place, did any of the clergy in Saudi Arabia or elsewhere accept Juhayman's claim that the Messiah had arrived?
No, they have not. And they had a very interesting debate because King Khalid of Saudi Arabia at the time had to summon the 30 leading ulama, Islamic scholars, for the issuance of this fatwa. And they had a very interesting debate on the merits of whether Muhammad Abdullah was the Mahdi. And one of the leading clerics, Sheikh Nasser al-Rashid, said, well, he can't really be the Mahdi because in the prophecies it says that he'll have to fight against 70,000 Jews from Isfahan but there aren't 70,000 Jews in Isfahan, a city in Iran, at this time. It says that he will be helped by Jesus, who will descend from the skies in the walled city of Damascus. Well, there are no walls around the city of Damascus now, so he's probably not the right guy.
So well, they're going to have to build walls and get more Jews into Isfahan.
Yeah, exactly. So in the meantime, you can go and recapture the mosque.
And the French government provided an elite military force to help rout the rebels from the mosque. Is that something that's known throughout the Islamic world?
The fact that the French were involved is known. What actually happened and how big was the force is not known, because one of the men who were in that unit has spoken about his involvement in somewhat exaggerated roles. The French didn't actually go into Mecca, as he claimed, but they played a very important role. The French government at the time was very determined to project its force around the world, unlike the Carter administration. The head of the French intelligence agency was Count Alexandre de Marange, who was himself half American. His mother was an American socialite, and he was a very determined cold warrior. He publicly described President Carter as a baby-faced Boy Scout at the time. And he was more than happy to help the Saudis and the siege of the shrine. And so he dispatched a plane load of poison gas and three commandos who taught the Saudis how to pump this gas into the basement of the mosque, which is really how the siege was ended in the final days of it.
It is ironic, isn't it, that the Americans and the Israelis were accused throughout the Islamic world for this whole incident, when in fact they had nothing to do with it, but the French were involved, and they haven't paid a price.
There were some Americans in there. There were some Americans converted to Islam in there, which is why their role in the whole affair was kept very secret up until now. I only discovered the existence of Americans among the rebels by reading the diaries of John West, who was at the time the American ambassador.
Where did the Americans come from? Were they converts who were part of some black American Islamic group, or were they more like people who discovered Islam and then went to the Middle East to learn more?
Well, you know, after Malcolm X went to Saudi Arabia in the 60s and left the Nation of Islam for a more orthodox, traditional form of Islam, there was a wave of similar conversions. And the Saudi government at the time really tried to finance and expand this phenomena, and brought very many young African Americans to study in schools and in academies in Saudi Arabia. And so most of them were brainwashed into this radical ideology already on campus, already while in Saudi Arabia.
My guest is Yaroslav Trofimov, whose latest book is The Siege of Mecca, The Forgotten Uprising in Islam's Holiest Shrine and the Birth of Al-Qaeda, published by Doubleday. Was the Bin Laden family construction company called in to repair the mosque after it had been retaken by the Saudi government?
Oh, yes. They repaired it, and they also greatly expanded it. So the mosque, as it is now, is a much larger structure than it was back in 1979.
How difficult was it for you, a non-Muslim, to gather information for this book? You couldn't go into Mecca, could you?
I couldn't go into Mecca, but I could go to Jeddah or Riyadh or other places where most of the survivors and witnesses live now. I also traveled to Egypt and to other Gulf countries to meet all these witnesses and participants in these events. And a few of them still have among the rebels at least, the former rebels, have still the very same rigid ideology. Some of them would ask me on the phone, "Are you a Muslim or a kafir, and an unbeliever?" And you know, upon hearing that, I'm not really Muslim, they would just hang up and refuse to see me. But others are very, very much more accommodating.
They want to get their word out, the message across?
Well, the more radical ones think there is no point in talking to non-Muslims. Full stop. They're just not part of the common humanity. Others, of course, were much more accommodating. And they did want to get this story out, of course.
I would think that there's somebody in the Saudi government, as there's always somebody in a government, who would also want this story known. There are always leaks, aren't there?
I have spoken to members of the government. I have interviewed Prince Turki, who at the time was the head of Saudi intelligence and was deeply involved in the attack on the mosque. And while I was talking to him, he was the Saudi ambassador in Washington. And I have spoken to other members of the Saudi military who were involved in this whole operation. But Prince Turki, for example, only met me towards the end of my research once he realized, I presume, that I have already talked to so many other people that an official version of the story would also be helpful.
Was his story at all similar to what you already knew?
Well, he told me what was happening in his circle, and some of the facts did cross-check. Yes, it was very helpful.
So, even though this book probably is the definitive history up to this point of what happened on that day, it will only perhaps be relevant to people who are outsiders, because if people won't talk to you, they're not going to read you either.
I'm not so sure. The book is being translated into Arabic. It is going to be published in the Arab world, probably going to be banned in Saudi Arabia itself, but it will be on sale in most other Arab countries. And
do you think you'll change some minds?
I probably will, and the information is as much news to people in the Muslim world as it is here in the West.
And why do you think it more people haven't tried to understand this in the West, since, as you point out, this is really a turning point? So much of what's happened since comes out of all of the rhetoric of this moment.
Well, I think the obstacles to finding out the truth and finding out what actually happened on the ground were quite high until recently. I was very lucky to be able to track down the witnesses, to track down the participants in these events. And also, the archives are really now starting to open up, especially the Western archives. And I have filed plenty of Freedom of Information Act requests that were answered just in time. And so I also could draw on this wealth of declassified materials that were not available up until now.
So the real shocker to me, as much as anything, was how little the American government knew about the Muslim world. This is something that we discovered again after the invasion of Iraq, that people had no idea of just how different the Sunnis and the Shiites are, what their history is. Do you think that people finally understand today, that people in this country understand today as a result of what's going on in Iraq?
I think there is a little bit more understanding, but I don't think people grasp the whole magnitude of problems in there. And what really bothers me now is the parallels between 79 and today. Today, again, we are so much focused on Iran and the threat posed by Iran that we forget about Saudi Arabia. Last year, when Hezbollah was fighting the Israeli soldiers in Lebanon, everybody in the U.S. was very happy that some Saudi clerics had condemned Hezbollah. But these are very same clerics who praised bin Laden, and the only reason they condemned Hezbollah is because they happen to be Shiites and therefore heretics. So, again, today I think we shouldn't fall into the same error of focusing so much on Iran and forgetting about the dangers of Saudi Arabia.
Is Saudi Arabia still pouring a lot of support into the spread of Wahhabism throughout the rest of Islam?
I think the government is trying somewhat to control what goes into this missionary network, but the money keeps pouring, and the religious establishment is quite autonomous in its operation from the government itself.
Yaroslav Trofimov is a staff foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He has been since 1999. He's the author of Faith at War, A Journey on the Front Lines of Islam from Baghdad to Timbuktu, and now his most recent book, The Siege of Mecca, The Forgotten Uprising in Islam's Holiest Shrine and the Birth of Al-Qaeda, published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
On tomorrow's show, Chris Matthews, host of MSNBC's Hardball, on how all of us can learn and apply lessons learned from politicians' tactics. And then BAM President Karen Brooks Hopkins and Next Wave Executive Producer Joseph Melillo, also a documentary on the complicated issue of abortion. Plus, we look into the controversial privately owned handgun manufacturer's Kar Arms, which has sales of around $20 million a year. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Rachel Krantz, Paula Crossfield, Tess Hartman, Scott Goldberg, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.